You're listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
My name is Sarah Cook. I'm the director of UNRISD, and I'm first delighted to see the room full again for one of our seminars, and particularly delighted that to introduce Magdalena Sepulveda, who I think most of you will know or know of, who is currently the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights. We also have the privilege of having her here visiting at UNRISD as a research fellow during this year. And Magdalena's work as Special Rapporteur, before that, she's a human rights lawyer with extensive experience in different institutions on international human rights and law, and has worked in a variety of institutions, including the Inter-American Court of Human Rights and the UN University for Peace in San Jose, Costa Rica, and previously in Geneva at the International Council on Human Rights Policy, which many of you would know. But I think we know her work particularly through her role as a Special Rapporteur, where I think there obviously are a number of Special Rapporteurs that really have made a big impact, and some of Magdalena's reports, particularly I think on poverty, social protection, the impact of austerity on the extreme poor, etc., have really come into the development debates. I think we're all becoming more familiar with how we use the instruments and the language of human rights in the areas where people like us in the development, who look at issues of poverty, social protection, how we can use those tools, but also where the gaps are between the discussion from a rights perspective and from a development perspective. I think we look back, certainly from when I was at IDS, and we would sort of discuss rights-based approach to development in very woolly terms. And I think now what we're seeing is really some clarity about what are the instruments, how are they useful to us, but what does development offer when you're thinking about rights approaches to really realizing the process of realizing those rights. And I think I'm very pleased to have Magdalena here so we can sort of have an ongoing conversation about these issues, which are not obvious and easy. And I think we still have a lot of questions we're grappling with. So I would just like to make a couple of announcements. Apparently, I've got to say some things. To inform you that the event is being recorded. It will be available on podcasts or on the web. There is live tweeting, and there's a participants form that we would request that you fill in before you leave. So I'm just going to hand over to Magdalena to talk for maybe up to 30 or so minutes, and then hopefully we'll really be able to have time for a good discussion following from that.
Thank you very much. It is really a pleasure for me to be here, and I feel very comfortable as being a UNRISD fellow and talking here today, so I'm very happy. I will try to speak briefly and to present the argument in order to have time for discussion. The whole idea today is to present why a human rights approach to social protection, it is needed, and it will provide additional tools to not only to make some social protection system more sustainable, but more than that, to respect the rights of the beneficiaries. I think that while social protection has gained prominence and political support in development and poverty reduction discourse over the past few years, and I think in an unprecedented manner, I think that there is still a very important analytical gap, that is the lack of analysis from a human rights perspective. While I recognize that there's been important development, the Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, which is the supervisory mechanism of the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, which for which there are more than 160 state parties, so it has a very broad ratification, already in 2008 issued a general comment on the right to social security that it is understood to include contributory and non-contributory systems, so the right to be benefited by social assistance and social insurance. And the social assistance part is the one that I'm very interested in. And of course, last year, the ILO recommendation 202 on social protection floor, although it does not mention human rights in the substantive part of the recommendation, it does mention human rights in the preface and several important human rights treaties. Despite that, it has a very important rights-based approach. However, if one consider the extensive number of obligations that the state have voluntarily assumed under human rights treaties, and the fact that all UN agencies have committed to mainstream human rights in their work, I think that the lack of a more systematic discussion of social protection from a human rights perspective is extremely concerning. I have worked with several experts for the past 5 years in order to develop what would be a human rights framework of social protection mechanism. And I have visited several countries and met with several beneficiaries of social protection system in order to inquire these human rights implications. And therefore, what is important to highlight here is two different approaches, and I'm going to try to address them both. On the one hand, I think that there is a strong evidence that social protection system can assist states in fulfilling their obligation under national, regional, and international human rights law to ensure the enjoyment of minimum essential level of economic, social, and cultural rights. So social protection system has helped states in ensuring, for example, minimum essential levels of the right to an adequate standard of living, the right to food, health, education, and the right to social security. However, social protection system or human rights obligation are important not only in the final result, not only by the fact that social protection system ensure or facilitate the enjoyment of certain rights, but human rights obligation limit the discretion of the states also in the way in which social protection systems are implemented. Therefore, a state must comply with several human rights principles and norms when implementing social protection system. And this is what I would like to refer today. The main obligation that the states have in this regard is ensuring an adequate legal and institutional framework and adopting a long-term strategy in regard to social protection system. Because it is a right, it is the right to social security, a state must incorporate this right into their legislative framework. We have seen, for example, that social protection system that have incorporated the right to social security or social protection within their system are better implemented. And South Africa and Brazil are a good example of this, where you have from the constitution to a law that it is that enshrine the right to social protection. However, oftentimes what we see is that social protection systems are based only on presidential decrees, policy statements, manuals, and guidelines that do not ensure the long-term strategy of rights. And this can seriously threaten the enjoyment of rights of the beneficiaries. This is extremely worrisome in some pilot schemes that have been implemented with external support. In order to have a strong, effective, transparent, and accountable social protection system, the requirements of a human rights approach, it is necessary that the beneficiaries know, for example, or are able to identify who are responsible for the implementation and the role of all those who are responsible in all the different stages of the implementation, from the local level to the national level. We have seen that when this is not done, there's been important threats and violations to the rights of the beneficiaries. For example, in Nicaragua, the Red de Protección Social, who was a program that it was implemented for a period of time, it was abruptly cancelled with a change of government, because it was not established in the legal and political system. In Guatemala, for example, a conditional cash transfer program, Mi Familia Progresa, was implemented or began his implementation without even having a registration system of the beneficiaries. This was not the only problem in Guatemala, but because of the lack of institutional and political and legal framework, it was politically manipulated. It didn't depend, so this program was not implemented by any ministry. It was implemented by the wife of the president, so the office of the wife of the president. This is pure charity. I mean, they generally, the wife of presidents in Latin America dedicate to charity. Then, if we say that this is a right, what we are stressing is that the right to social security is not charity, it's a right. So this implementation without the adequate institutional framework, of course, was open to corruption and political manipulation. Not only including, the benefit of having a good institutional legal framework not only ensure fiscal sustainability, but it is very important, as I said, or what I would like to emphasize, to the enjoyment of rights. This legal framework should include, as a minimum, the precise eligibility requirements, the mechanism for transparency and access to information. It should define various roles and responsibilities for all those involved, should articulate long-term financial requirements, should establish accessible complaints and appeal mechanism, and should establish participatory channels. A second very important principle in which it is important that we concentrate, because it's the basis of a human rights-based approach, are the principles of equality and non-discrimination. This is at the core of a human rights approach. The respect of this principle has several important implications in the implementation of a social protection system. First, it is to incorporate a gender perspective. And this is quite important, that the gender perspective should be incorporated from the design, the implementation, and the evaluation of the system. Making women the direct beneficiaries of social protection system in some country does not ensure gender equality. If we look at at conditional cash transfer programs, for example, that tend to be channeled through a female head of household, we know there is evidence that by targeting women, there is an improve in education, health, and nutritional level for some members of the family, in particular children. We have some evidence on some programs that by channeling, for example, conditional cash transfer or cash transfer to women, they feel more empowered. However, this does not necessarily transform gender relations or ensure a comprehensive protection of women's rights. Sometimes these programs, by channeling or in particular, I would say conditional cash transfer programs, by imposing co-responsibilities on women, they perpetuate the stereotyped roles in society, the roles of women in society, instead of challenging them, and reinforce the patriarchal attitude in certain societies. Recognizing the rights of women required, for example, to take into account the role of women as caregiver, in the design of the program. We have seen, for example, in some there is evidence from some conditional cash transfer programs in Latin America, for example, the Oportunidades programs in Mexico, that there's been the fact of requiring women to comply with certain co-responsibilities open the space for the views of the system by other stakeholders. In the case of Mexico, there is evidence, for example, that there has been some abuse from healthcare providers, that women have to take their children to medical checkup and vaccines. And there's been examples of abuse, these healthcare providers against these women. In Colombia, there's been evidence of abuses by the teachers that has to certify the compliance with the requirements of children going to school. In Bangladesh, there is anecdotal evidence that a female secondary school assistant program, that it is a stipend for girls going to secondary school that act as a condition, is similar to a conditional cash transfer program, because girls are required to comply with certain level of assistance and certain level of grade, some abuse of teachers in order to certify this compliance. Therefore, what is important is that these possibilities are taken into account in the design and in the evaluation, for example, of the social protection system in order to gather information and be able to act and redress. Another important implication of the principles of equality and non-discrimination is ensuring non-discrimination and equality in the selection of the beneficiaries. In this sense, I have to say that universal access to social protection system, it is more in line with human rights norms. However, human rights do not preclude the fact that sometimes there is a possibility due to limitation in resources to have a progressive implementation of a universal system, but the aim should be a universal system. But the selection, even if it's a targeted system, the mechanism has to comply with certain requirements. They be objective, reasonable, transparent, and should ensure that there is no stigmatization, in the implementation of the mechanism. Why universal programs are more in line with human rights? Well, they avoid stigmatization, they reduce opportunities for corruption, and also have other benefits like lower administrative cost. But overall, they're best situated to satisfy with the human rights obligation. When, for example, and this is important to look in every specific case, but if there is a mean test, testing a mechanism or a proxy mean test mechanism to implement a social protection system, immediately the system become more complex and more opaque, making the eligibility requirements for the beneficiary very difficult to grasp. If the beneficiaries do not know why they are or they are not receiving the benefit, this impairs their ability to scrutinize and monitor the system, and more importantly, impede their right to claim their entitlement. Therefore, it really has a difficulty in that regard. This, of course, can be minimized, but what I'm trying to stress here is that this issues that making opaque or complex the mechanism that the beneficiaries might not understand, are issues that need to be taken into account beforehand, as well as the potential of intra-community conflict that a very tight proxy mean test mechanism can produce. Community targeting mechanism can also have raised concern from a human rights perspective. If they're implemented by a community that is not well trained, or there are not sufficient monetary mechanism to ensure that there are no abuses, what might happen is that this community targeting mechanism can reinforce the power structures in the community or patron-client's relation, as well as the local gender norms. For example, there is evidence that in some, in the implementation of some community targeting mechanism, some women that are considered of low reputation by the community, that has been abandoned by their husband, or older women accused of witchcraft, they are not benefiting from the program because the community take the rational decision to exclude them. So the community target mechanism should also take into account and should build in mechanism to avoid further exclusion of certain already very excluded women in the community, for example, or it might be minorities or any other ground of discrimination. It is important to assess the impact of the methodology in terms of minimizing the exclusion or the potential exclusion of beneficiaries. In short, from a rights perspective, inclusion and exclusion errors are not the same. Of course, an exclusion error is much more grave, if you want, from a rights perspective. When policymaker has to take this decision whether or not to have more inclusion or exclusion error, I would say that from a rights perspective, it will be better to have, let's say, the Brazilian approach in oportunidades, that they assume that although they might have inclusion errors, they're trying to minimize exclusion errors. Equality and non-discrimination also requires the compliance with what in human rights called the A standards, the accessibility, adaptability, acceptability, and adequacy of the social protection system. So it is important in terms of accessibility, for example, to assess that some administrative requirement, such as identity documents or fill complex forms or fill forms that require a certain level of literacy, have an impact in excluding the most vulnerable groups in society, and in particular women. Why? Because due to a structural discrimination against women, they are generally the ones that lack identity documents, for example, or are suffer more from illiteracy. Distance is also a crucial thing. I mean, the physical accessibility to, for example, collecting the benefits. If we look, just to give you an example, in the Kenya Hunger Safety Net program, 8.3% of the household work more than 4 hours to collect the money, and in average, everybody has to work around 90 minutes to collect the benefits. This, of course, has an enormous implication for persons with disabilities, older persons, and certain groups, and even women with care responsibilities. So again, what I'm stressing here is the need to take this into account in advance. The same happened with electronic method of payments. There's been good studies that show that some electronic method of payment discriminate certain older persons that have less easiness in doing or working with this electronic method of payment. It should also be adaptable to the need of the population, and this is very important. It's, of course, very obvious, but it's not always taken into account. Just to give you an example, the Bolsa de Maio program, a cash transfer program that is implemented in Timor del Este, it is almost a copy of the Bolsa de Familia in Brazil. So, and this idea that you can copy a system implemented in a middle-income country in a low-income country is completely mad, but they actually have some papers in which they even recognize that there are taking it from the Bonsai Familia, and they're very proud of that. But this is the stupid thing, I believe. It has to be culturally accessible, but taking into account the multiple form of discrimination on the grounds of race, gender, sex, class, etc. And of course, this has to be examined case by case in the different programs. Going to another point, a rights-based approach, I mean, leaving non-discrimination for the moment, also required to ensure that the implementation of co-responsibilities does not undermine human rights beneficiaries. The arguments in favor of imposing co-responsibilities in some generally cash transfer programs, but in some other programs as well, as I said, for example, the Bangladesh stipend, secondary girls' stipend program, act as similar to a conditional programs as required certain conditions. So I'm talking conditions in general. One is that those who support this conditions or co-responsibility, I think that is the change name is pure rhetoric, so I still believe that we can call it conditions. But these co-responsibilities are necessary to influence the behaviors and attitude of the beneficiaries in order to improve the outcomes in health, education, etc., to improve the investment in human capital. Another argument is that by imposing these co-responsibilities, the program is more likely to be perceived as benefiting the deserving poor and thereby facilitating the political and social support of the program that, of course, is important when implemented. And another argument is that these co-responsibilities might contribute to the self-esteem and the autonomy of the beneficiaries as they feel that they're not receiving something for nothing. To be honest, I found all this argument absolutely against human rights. First, the first argument, assume that people living in poverty cannot take rational decisions in regard to their livelihood or how to improve their livelihood. By imposing conditions or co-responsibilities in this way, it undermines the autonomy and the freedom to choose by people living in poverty. In addition, I think that, as some critics has stressed, there is no sound social and economic evidence that by imposing conditionalities, we achieve a better impact in the desired outcome of health and education. Therefore, without this evidence, I think that it's very difficult to continue arguing on co-responsibility. I think that also by imposing additional co-responsibilities or conditionalities, the administrative cost of monitoring the conditionalities are higher. In Mexico, for example, the enforcement of conditionalities on the Oportunidades program represent 24% of the overall administrative cost, but also required some private cost that has to assume the beneficiaries. And I think that money might be better spent in expanding the program. From a rights perspective, everybody has the right to enjoy minimum essential levels of all economic, social, and cultural rights, minimum subsistence level, without any conditions. These rights are not conditioned to any obligation or co-responsibility on the part of those who are entitled to these rights. Therefore, from a rights perspective, I think that is extremely... There is a huge tension between imposing conditionalities and respecting human rights. In the only rights that I think that there is some possibility to have a different approach will be on the right to education, because in that right there is a more clear responsibility of the parents or the guardians in regard to the education of children. But otherwise, I think that is extremely complex to to comply with the human rights and respect autonomy of a person living in poverty. I believe that while it is an important argument, the need of policymakers and society to accept this program, and therefore, if they are if they perceive that these programs are benefiting the deserving poor, they're going to provide more support. I think that the problem there is the way in which we are selling the program. Because, as I said, from a rights perspective, this is not charity. I mean, those who are benefiting from social protection programs have the right to receive the program. Therefore, this is not a way in which we can argue, oh, no, they're going to feel better if they sign something, if they comply with the responsibility, because they're going to feel that they're not receiving something for nothing. No. I mean, we have to sell the program, really establishing from the start that what they are receiving is that something that they're entitled for. And this implied several other rights that they have, as in regard to monitoring the program and making administrators of the program accountable for the way in which they're implementing the program. Moving to another principle that they have to respect, and I have two more, so three
five
more
minutes.
And finish. No, less than 10. For ensuring transparency and access to information. Limit access to information impede beneficiaries of the ability to claim their rights and increase the likelihood that the programs or the resources allocated to the programs are going to be mismanaged. Transparency must not be limited only to the financial aspect of a social protection system or a program. It should cover all core elements of the program: the targeting mechanism, the eligibility criteria, the benefit level, the complaint and redress mechanism. From a rights perspective, everybody has the right to seek and receive information from the state. Therefore, the state has an obligation to facilitate the request for information about any given social program. Therefore, in order to comply with this, social protection programs or mechanism should have built-in mechanism to facilitate access to information, not only by the beneficiaries, but by the society at large. Another principle is ensuring meaningful and effective participation. Participatory mechanism cannot be pro forma. They must take into account the symmetries of powers in the community, and they have to address the unequal decision-making powers and try to redress this unequal decision-making powers, not only at the community level, but also at the household level. The participatory mechanism has, they must be designed taking into account any gender approach. An example: the Plan Jefas y Jefas, Hogar Desocupado, a conditional cash transfer program in Argentina that is for unemployed men or women, head of household, had established municipal advisory councils, called in Spanish Consejos Consultivos. Well, this municipal advisory council that were a participatory mechanism of this program were co-opted by men and by their clientelism network. Therefore, what happened was that basically a program that was benefiting a great majority of women was controlled or by men. And this is the type of things that should not happen. There was no quota established for women, and the great majority of those who were part of this municipal advisory council were men in this program that were that was benefiting mainly women. Ensuring access to accountability mechanism and effective remedies. Of course, this is the core of a human rights approach. We have seen good examples in some programs. And again, I have to refer to cash transfer programs because there have been largely studies. The Bolsa de Familia program, for example, have very important social control committees at the local level that act as a very important accountability mechanism. In order to ensure good accountability mechanism in the program, they have to be gender accessible, they have to be cultural appropriate, but they also have to comply with several other requirements to ensure accessibility by the most disadvantaged group. For example, they should be they should accept anonymous complaint, they should be designed taking into account low level of literacy, they should take into account alternative language. In Brazil and Mexico, for example, toll-free numbers in some social programs have proved to be very effective mechanism of accountability and monitoring. And as I said, it has to be taken into account all different grounds of discrimination. A good example is the Bono de Desarrollo Humano, a cash transfer program in Ecuador, had a very good toll-free number, in which this toll-free number, there were several operators, it was working almost 24/7. All of them, all the operators were speaking Spanish, while 47% of the beneficiary of the programs were indigenous people who speak Quechua. So, again, the main problem here, when we look at this program from a rights perspective, I think it's good. This provides a good example on what are the different. If I have limited resources as a state, and I have to, and I make this very positive state to provide, for example, a toll-free number mechanism for accountability, well, if I exclude those who are most disadvantaged and suffering from a structural discrimination, it is a problem. In that sense, for example, I will prefer they would have started only with Quechua-speaking operators and then move progressively to the Spanish one, or at least to have some sort of proportion in order to be in line with the human rights mechanism. I'm going to stop here. I think that I have said several issues that will raise discussion, so I'm open for any comments, discussion, or criticism. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for, I think, a talk that really will stimulate a lot of thoughts. Let me just say a couple of points. I think what it provides for me a very clear framework for thinking, not just, and I think in the development field we often do focus on the rights as the outcome, the protection of rights, the realization of rights, and development as sort of part of that process of getting there. But I think the framework for really analyzing exactly in a very concrete case with very specific, drilling down to very detailed procedural issues of a rights analysis framework for thinking about the development process or the process of getting to those frameworks, I think is very important. You know, and the social protection field seems to provide a very good example where you can trace down to those details, but of course the framework could be applied much more widely. I think for me the big question for many development people, probably the big question comes back to the state as the duty bearer, which is obviously critical, and then a lot of this requires the state, the accountability mechanisms of the state itself, how the state capacities are put in place, what really are the conditions under which you can achieve this kind of role, and particularly, again, from a development point of view, in a development institute, in a context where I think all of the arguments about rights relates to our approaches, our arguments about universalism in social policy, the kind of approach we've taken. And yet we're operating in a context, and states are operating in a context where the power given to corporate or market actors really constrains the capacity to push these arguments and to make these arguments in a way that gains traction in what is often a very problematic sort of context. And so I think, again, when we're talking to international financial institutions who have a lot of power over the nature of social protection programs, some of the donors, the nature of evidence they want to decide on exactly how they're going to do it, how we really bridge these gaps between the rights approach that you're presenting and the kind of context in which we're trying to do some of these things. But I think it's a really good framework for debating these issues. So I open the floor And look forward to, I'll take a few questions and then come back to Magdalena and then take another round. So who wants to start? Yes, Lisa.
Hi, Elena. My name is Elena Gaya. I work for UNICEF in the Europe Central Asia region, which is a region you didn't mention in your speech. And I would like to ask two questions. First of all, we fully agree with the framework you proposed, actually. You know, so my questions are more to push the envelope even further rather than criticize or, you know. And the first is, you mentioned, you know, you seem to focus very much on the cash transfer part of social protection. While, for example, we in UNICEF, we also include under the realm of the right to social protection all these programs, non-cash program, kind of human resource intensive support programs, a la Chile Solidario, where you have a component of support to families to, you know, resolve a range of vulnerabilities, because, you know, we know that only economic aid, even if it's done in a human rights framework, can end up being charity if it doesn't help to bring about some solutions. So I was wondering if in your further work you plan to do some reflection also on this type of support, you know, social worker accompanying families, and what are the human rights implications of the way it's being done in several countries, most notably it's now pioneered in Latin America, but, you know, Europe has a bit more of experience of that. I would be interested to hear if you plan to go in that direction. And the second question is about the participation element. Because, again, when we work in this area in upper middle income countries, especially in this part of the world, you know, we don't have that community dimension that you cited several times when you look at the issue of voice and, you know, transparency. You know, we are working in highly individualized society where the beneficiaries of these programs don't know each other because of the non-transparency of the selection that you mentioned also. So how do we think about the participation and the collective action in a different context than the community, you know, widespread poverty reduction programs that you mentioned, when social protection in upper middle income countries is targeting mostly the most vulnerable, the really excluded, who probably even don't know each other, they're not probably organized. So how do we actually generate the type of community development that has been successful in some of the cases?
Other questions?
Thank you. My name is Pascal. I'm a researcher concerning water issues. I would like to hear from Mr. Spoon that some point of views regarding the framework of human rights and social development, where you could increase the water access in communities when we can see more and more some governments and some companies installing their business in these small regions, and they don't really care about the water access as concerned all these communities. Thank you.
Are there issues? Yes, please.
From UNCTAD, and I have two questions. You mentioned that one of the risks of not properly designed social protection programs is to reinforce the role, for example, of women in society, etc., and asymmetric roles, etc. For instance, I think that quite often it's supposed that women will take children to the doctors, etc., or in some social housing programs in Brazil, when popular houses were built, the titles were automatically given to women rather than to men, because it's supposed that women are more responsible for family and men will just sell the houses and disappear, etc. So this is reinforcing the role of women as the bearer of family responsibilities. But, I mean, what would be your advice, I mean, if this is the case in the ground? And I have another question on what you mentioned on universal access, saying that this is more compatible with human rights, in a sense, rather than targeting. But the point is that if you go immediately for universal access rather than targeting the most vulnerable, the poor, etc., etc., don't you run the risk of the benefits being captured by those who have more access, who are more literate, better informed, etc., than those who are more in need of social protection, meaning the illiterate, the people living in more isolated areas, and people who have less physical or intellectual access to information and to institutions?
Okay. Okay, I have one more question here.
Yes, I'd like to ask you a question about subsidies. My name is Catherine Anderson. I work with the Water Supply and Sanitation Collaborative Council. So we're working in the WASH sector, where we found that subsidies have been replaced by a new approach called community-led total sanitation. So rather than giving people subsidies to get toilets, we're directly working with behaviour change specialists so that communities create their own toilets. So the fact that this subsidy approach does present an opportunity for difficulties in access and corruption, and that it's been replaced in the WASH sector by this community-led total sanitation approach. Are there other parallels in subsidy-driven approaches in other sectors? I'd be interested to hear from you, since you have an overview of the sector.
Okay, one more, and then I'll come back to Magdalena. Please.
I'm Hamish Jenkins from NGLS. Just have two questions. One is, if the rights-based approach suggests that cash transfers, for example, shouldn't be conditional on medical checkups and ensuring that the money is enables children to go to school, what other mechanisms would you recommend to ensure that these things happen? One could argue that giving money to women rather than men is a form of conditionality to ensure that the money isn't spent in beer but rather in food and things like that. And the other, if it's maybe it's a stupid question, but maybe you could elaborate on why it was such a bad idea to implement the Bolsa Familia program in East in Timor.
Good. Well, you've got a number of questions, I think, covering a range of issues: care, social services, gender, sort of related issues, which we just had a two-day workshop on with Magdalena, so there's lots to say. Water has been a big thing, subsidies, and
Okay. I'm going to start with the last one, and I'm going to try to build on that. First of all, I'm going to, in terms of why I have applied this, I think that what I've tried to develop is really the standards. I mean, what implied to have an institutional framework and access to information and transparency and participation, that then in this presentation I have applied to, in particular, cash transfer programs, because it provides a good example. The whole idea of this talk is to challenge a little bit the fact that there is kind of this new development paradigm, and I think that this new paradigm should look more into human rights. So that is, but the whole, all the principles can be applied to any social policy, and it's just provide you what are the arguments that you should, not the argument, but the issues that you should look at. And of course, in some other social programs, you have to look at other things. But if we look at, for example, the provision of social services, it is the same. And then the accessibility, adaptability, cultural adequacy, physical accessibility, etc. I mean, those are very much in the provision of social services as well. So it is just a general framework that I think it can be applied in different social policies. That is one. And then on participation, this is an issue that is extremely, extremely relevant. And actually, on the 28th of May, I'm going to submit my most recent report, that is on participation of people living in poverty in decisions that affect their life. I think that there is some copies of the report here, but otherwise in the website of UNRIST for this talk, you will have a link to several of the reports that I have done, and also to the report on participation that tried to do the same. I mean, participation being an issue that has been discussed widely in a development framework and an economic framework, then this report presents this from what would be the human rights normative framework. So I invite you to, if you're interested to look that report, so I just don't go into details into that. Now, the issue of conditionalities, that it seems that it was in several of the questions. I agree. I mean, there is evidence that by providing assistance to women, you have better outcome in terms of health and education with children, for example. I mean, that is a fact. What I'm challenging here is that if by using that fact, let's say, that you improve this outcome without taking into account the fact, for example, that you're increasing unpaid care work on women and that you are assuming that simply women have the capacity to take more and more unpaid care work without limitation of any kind, that is some sort of, and this would have been discussing the last 2 years, that this is an unlimited resource, it creates problems on women's rights. What about the right of women to actually access to health? The health impact on increasing care work on women and pay care work on women. But what even about the right to leisure? I mean, let's all the right to education. So it is important. I'm not challenging that this should not be done. What I'm challenging is that this has to be done, taken into account, and considering the fact that the unpaid care work of women is going to increase. So you have to take other more comprehensive measures to address this issue. These measures are not limited to the social protection program. And indeed, I mean, I hope that I don't need to say it, and I think it is obvious. I'm not claiming that social protection system is the panacea for poverty eradication. This is one tool that has to be inserted in a much more comprehensive type of measure. So if we're going to use that, let's make sure, as a state, then public service provision is going to be up to standard, accessible to women at a short distance, that we're going to have other mechanisms in place to encourage men to take children to the medical checkup. I mean, you can design the programs trying to encourage men to take a more active participation. You can also ensure, for example, these programs generally increase a lot. I mean, women's are not only required, for example, to take children to medical school, to medical checkup, or that they comply with their school assistant. They also have to participate in several meetings. But sometimes this ridiculous amount of meeting that they have to attend in order to receive the benefit. But if at least some of these meetings are extremely necessary for the implementation of the program, ensure that you address gender concern in this meeting with men and women, domestic violence, early marriage. So you can build in the whole program trying to have a more important gender approach and trying to tackle somehow the causes of gender inequality and not only reinforcing. The problem that I see is that sometimes the gender approach is considered by policymakers as a collateral beneficial impact. So they think that by giving or channeling the program through women, all gender issues are addressed, that was all that they need. And if the program empower women, it's like a beneficial collateral impact of the program. But this cannot be that way. It should be from the design to the evaluation. And then the evaluation of the program as well. It has to incorporate gender-sensitive questions to see how the program has impacted differently in men and women. And unfortunately, generally, in my view, this is not done. There are very important exceptions, I will say, but generally, this is not done. And these programs are implemented as if they were gender-neutral, and they are not. In Timor-Leste, it's a very interesting thing, because what they were trying to do by copying the Bolsa de Familia program, the Brazil program, is that the Bolsa de Familia program is a very good program. It's a conditional cash transfer program, but actually it is really non-punitive, the conditionality. So basically, if I can explain in simple way, the conditionality, it is used by the system as a way to get an alert of what are the problems with the families. So if a family doesn't comply with the conditionality, they receive several alert and communication, but at the end, a social worker is sent to the family. So nobody is excluded or no family is excluded from the program until a social worker has approached the family and examined what are the impediments that that particular family is having in order to enjoy the program. That is one good example that in Timor, I think that there are less than 10 social workers in all the country. So just forget about that implementation. But more importantly is the fact of the availability of public services. A conditional cash transfer program cannot be implemented in low-income countries in which you do not have the provision of public services for which the condition to continue in the programs depend on. I mean, if women cannot... I mean, there is no medical service, how you're going to make it conditional to that? So these are the problems. And also, they were implementing, for example, a very, very expensive mechanism to register the beneficiaries and also to graduate the beneficiaries. So graduate means that at a certain point they will not continue to receiving the benefits because they will not be considered to be beneficiaries on the level of poverty. When the great majority of your population live below the national poverty line, to monitor after 2 years whether or not some of these families have graduated, in my view, it is just a waste of resources. So then, the issue that Sarah also raised, the important issue about human rights is having the state has the major duty bearer. It's not the only from human rights, but it's the major, and the role of other actors from corporations to international financial institutions and all that. I think that it's true. I mean, I think that this is a limitation of a human rights approach that is changing gradually. More and more human rights, the human rights framework is addressing the responsibility of other actors. But with this limitation, what I would like to say is that I see the human rights approach the human rights approach does not resolve all the policy questions or the complexities that policymakers has to confront when designing social policies. But it is an additional tool, and it has very important advantages. I believe, for example, that by stressing some points from a rights perspective can help in building social support to certain policy changes that one would like to achieve. And it also, in my view, provide a lot of legitimacy as it is a set of principles and norms that are universally accepted. So I think that it is important to work from different angles. And in this miscommunication between the human rights people and the development people, I think that one approach is not to replace the other, but just to work together to achieve the desired goals of making social policies more sustainable, more efficient. Efficient might not be the word. I mean, I'm not talking about the World Bank efficiency, but to make it more respectful of the rights of the beneficiaries. So that from a rights-based perspective are not beneficiaries, but those who are entitled to the issues. So I don't know if... And in terms of subsidies, unfortunately, I don't have the knowledge to address that question comprehensively. So,
okay, well, we've got a few more minutes. We'll take another round of questions. And I think one of the issues that would be very interesting also to hear about or to raise debates about are really, you know, many of you work for organizations, which UN or other, where there's also... you know, possibly a rights-based approach, implicit or explicitly. I mean, if you're in the UN, we all sign up, essentially, to that approach. And yet, when we're at the phase of either making arguments for something or trying to implement, there are obstacles. And I think part of what maybe we need to be moving towards is sort of where you were at the end. Where really are the obstacles that, and how do we overcome those using both the rights framework and what we know from a development framework? And I think those are sort of, you know, moving forward, because I think we're all essentially on the same territory with some maybe little differences, but yet we're still not quite pushing some of these things in practice to where we need to get to, and what really are the blockages and how do we overcome them? But anyway, a few more questions. Katia.
Thanks so much, Elena, for the very interesting presentation. I just have one question, whether you can maybe tell us a little bit from your experience of having visited so many countries and spoken, as you said, to many people and officials who are actually implementing social protection programs. What is, from your experience, the kind of positive cases where countries or social protection agencies have actually taken into account human rights frameworks, and maybe with the same level of resources spent, you know, because you have visited different countries, low-income countries, middle-income countries, with the same level of resources have made a difference. So what is the kind of recipe, you know, do these agencies have kind of advisors, external, internal, etc.? Are there some lessons, you know, how this can be done better?
Okay, one, and I'll come to John. Yeah.
My name is Jen. I'm from UNICEF as well. I just had a question in regards to participation versus program design and the sort of inherent tension between what communities may. Okay, basically, I thought of this when you mentioned about making sure that or trying to implement ways that women. Are ensured that they're not overburdened by some of the conditionalities of cash transfers, you know, for example, having requirements that men maybe take children to medical appointments or something like that. But it just brought to my mind the tension between becoming overly prescriptive in order to realize, make sure, that in order to alleviate one human rights issue, and thereby sort of encroaching on other human rights issues such as participation or community input and things like this. And I feel like there's a tension there that is always going to have to be addressed in especially in conditional cash transfer programs or in programs where there's one agency or a government, ideally working together, but in some cases we know that on the ground there are a lot of times it's very much agency driven. And so how do you reconcile those tensions between making something truly community driven but also trying to ensure that the human rights are being respected in a holistic manner?
Joanna, do you want to, you have some Twitter questions, maybe just one or two. Sorry.
And my name's Joanna Cable. I have some questions which have come in on Twitter. To the other communications team. The first one is, I'll read it out, I think. You said minimum level of social security and adequacy of social service. So do you, and this has come over several tweets, because this is obviously a lot more than 140 characters. Okay, so do you think the minimum level left to the government's decision, like in the case of the social protection floor, can that guarantee the adequate level of social service? That was question number one.
Okay. You could be selective in what you...
And then the second question says, to me, the concept of progressive implementation looks like a black box. You mentioned long-term planning and the abolition of built-in mechanisms for discrimination, etc., etc. Could you elaborate that concept a little bit more?
Okay. Any one last question to add to the list? Or everybody's... Okay, I'll hand back to you then.
Katya, I luckily I think that I have very positive examples of compliance with the recommendations or the rights-based approach in the visit, and this is mainly because governments are not monolithic. So oftentimes, what I can recommend from a rights-based approach resonate or is actually what somebody within the system and within the government has been battling, but probably I have a very concrete experience, for example, in Ecuador, in which the director of the social protection system saw my recommendation. The system is this: when I do a country visit, an official country visit, I prepare the report that is shared with the government in a confidential basis first, and then the government provide me with their views or comments on the report. It depends, but sometimes it is a cut and paste of the responses of different ministries, and when I'm provided with this view, it's quite clear to me who is in favor and who is against. So it is oftentimes the Minister of Finance that is against, thinking that it is impossible to implement any of the recommendation. But then you see that the comments coming from the ministries of social development or the Minister of Labor or whatever, different, more other ministries, can directly say, this is what I've been fighting for a long time, and yet I have not received the funds to do this. So it resonates, and because, as I said, governments are not monolithic, and then the human rights argument, it is an additional argument that can be used internally at those who support this change, in order to push for a change, it is easier to achieve. And this happens more often than one can expect. Although the whole system, it is a weak system in terms of implementation. I go to a country, I prepare this report, I engage in a dialogue with the government at the Human Rights Council, and then I do some follow-up whether or not they are compliant with the recommendation. What is very interesting is that my interlocutor, it is a different government entity. It's the Minister of Foreign Affairs that is normally not an actor on this issue. But it is the Minister of Foreign Affairs that has the responsibility, actually, to collect the information and to kind of communicate back within the government that this recommendation should be complied with. And in my view, this triggered an important issue. The ministries of foreign affairs generally have the duty to always say that their countries are compliant with human rights, are in compliance with human rights. And to be honest, no country wants to be seen as in non-compliant with human rights, even though they always complain and try to damage the system. So this helped a lot, in my view, to achieve this more, let's say, development outcomes that this mandate has to work with. So, but it's always like that. Sometimes, for example, now I've been kind of invited to enter into a discussion with governments that are more less open, let's say, to the human rights discussion, because they see this mandate as less controversial. Of course, this is not the torture mandate. It is not the disappearance mandate. So sometimes I get access to countries that other mandates are not invited because they see this mandate as less controversial. When states are also campaigning to be members of the Human Rights Council, and it has happened in several of my latest visits, they have to show to the Human Rights Council and in the UPR, in the Universal Periodic Review System, that they're complying with the recommendation of the special procedures. So in some way or another, even if it's for the wrong reasons, they complied with the recommendation of the extreme poverty mandate that is politically less contested. So, and I think that even if it's for the wrong reasons, I have tried to exploit that openness to try to achieve some changes that I think that are important. Then participation. I'm not quite clear if I understood correctly your question, but I think that participation is crucial, and it is costly. I mean, the type of participation that you are required to do from a human rights approach that required as a minimum to first assess what are the symmetries of power in the community that you're going to work with. And after you have done that assessment, tailor a mechanism, a participatory mechanism that can minimize the exclusion and try to balance these asymmetries of power. It takes time. It required local knowledge. So you cannot do it by consultants that coming from Washington to do it in 2 weeks. And it required also a long-term engagement by the state. This means that I don't think that this type of participatory mechanism that are required from a rights perspective can be done when you have a very short time frame for your project, that you have to implement a project in 2-3 years, and you're completely external to the country without a multi-sectorial engagement, a local multi-sectorial engagement of the ministries relevant for the project. Because it's true. I mean, if you have to comply with certain outcome in a short time frame, you're more likely to work in the community with those who speak the language in which you can communicate. So, and you're going to be more likely, as it was said in the other question, to work with those who are better off in the community, because you're going to have a better accessibility to them and not to other. So I believe that a human rights, a truly human rights participatory mechanism required several conditions that required engagement of the state, required time, that it is more costly. But at the end of the day, it's going to be less costly in the sense that it's going to ensure better sustainability of the program, and it's going to ensure that the program is going to be better targeted to the needs of the community that you're working with, and it's going to be more successful overall. But definitely, it is difficult. It's required much more time and more resources as well.
Great, thank you. I think unless there's any urgent, okay, we've got one or two urgent questions. I'm just going to
Spurgeon respond to tweeted questions.
The Twitter questions.
Oh, yes.
Do you have something you want to add?
The progressive realization, well, the social protection floor, I think that if it's well implemented, can indeed, to some extent, guarantee minimum essential level of its rights. I think that it has been designed with that into account. I mean, that is one of the aim. And this also required or is linked to the issue of the progressive realization of rights. And I think that this is also very important from a human rights point of view. The progressive realization of rights is in regard to the maximum available resources. And the maximum available resources, in short, doesn't look only to the existing resources of the state, but also required certain obligations of the state in regard to, for example, to expanding the fiscal space and seeking for other avenues to increase the available resources for the enjoyment of this right. So it's a very complex obligation that it has several ramifications. It has been also interpreted by the supervisory body of the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, where this article on the maximum available resources is established, that it refers not only to local resources, that countries that do not have sufficient resources implied an obligation to seek international assistance and cooperation in order to comply with their obligation. But the point that I would like to stress here is that as my own critique to the human rights approach, I think that oftentimes the human rights advocates, we have neglected this part of availability of resources and the revenue size of the resources. But I think that luckily this has been addressed lately, and we have seen in recent years how human rights advocates are more and more tackling issues that deal with this issue of available resources. And again, from my point of view, the human rights movement has benefited from the fact that being a few years ago, or from the beginning of the movement, more than 60 years ago, a movement that it was composed mainly by lawyers. Nowadays, we see more and more economists and progressive economists and feminist economists and sociologists and anthropologists doing human rights work. So I think that the movement has evolved, and the international human rights standards, they have evolved to have a more comprehensive view of this issue. But there's still much work to do on the part of human rights advocates to tackle very important issues that we have, or the movement have, neglected.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I think what we've got really is, apart from the specific details, but some principles and some clear, you know, ways of thinking about frameworks for addressing, particularly in the social policy field. I think we still have to think about, well, what does this mean beyond social policy for those policies, and you've sort of started to get at the economic, the ministries of finance, that really do fundamentally affect social policy and the way social policy is framed. And I think that the other big issue that I still, you know, hope we can discuss more is really the role, it's still very much between rights, the mandates, human rights approach and states. And I think we're all working for different development agencies, UN, particularly the UN, I think are critical here, but also there are many others. If they're not taking those frameworks in the development programs they're doing, if they're really the key players influencing a lot of the design of social protection programs and many other areas of policy. So how do, you know, the people, the mandate holders like yourself really sort of try and provide the tools, or it may not be your responsibility, but then who provides the tools and the accountability mechanisms that these same approaches are coming from all the UN agencies working in these fields and the Bretton Woods institutions and others. So I think there's still clearly a sort of lot of work to do in taking these, I think, really helpful frameworks that I think help us to think through these issues, but then that they're picked up by many other agencies. And I think finally, you know, for future conversations is what this means for UNRISD and our research agenda, and where are the ways in our own, particularly our social policy work, but other areas of our work, we could think, you know, what would be useful as a research agenda around these issues, or how does this inform our research, the questions we're asking, the way we're analysing the impacts and of programmes. So I think there's a lot of food there for thought for all of us. So let me ask you all to join in thanking Magdalena very much for a very rich
Check out our other podcasts available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. Thank you for listening.